All right. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Brew University Virtual Roundtable. Glad to see you all with us here this morning. And I am your host, Jeff Weaver, Training Director for J.J. Taylor. And I am excited because I have a special guest in studio with me. I don't get to have people in the studio so far. This is a new fun adventure for us. But Zach Cavanaugh is here with us this morning, our new Corporate Vice President and CFO in Training. Good morning, Zach. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We're excited to have you with us for this episode of the Brew University Virtual Roundtable. I know we're doing this at 9:30 in the morning. We usually do these in the afternoon, and you did ask if we could drink at this, and I said, well, it's 9:30. A beer might be difficult, but thankfully we work for a good beer company. So I did bring hard coffee, so feel free if you like. Welcome, and thank you for being here. Cheers.
Thank you for hosting.
All right, so let's dive right into it. You've joined the company. The big news, obviously, is that you're here. Our current CFO, Hank Desplaines, is going to be transitioning, not fully retiring, but transitioning into more of an advisory role year end. Tell us a little bit about how you decided to get involved and get started, because I think most people at this point know the basics, which is that you've come to us from a background outside of the beer business, coming into the beer business, and of course the big headline that I'm bearing is you're John Taylor's son-in-law, so that certainly helps in deciding where to work next. So give us a little bit of the background of the story. How'd you end up coming on to the business?
Sure. So the story really goes back to, it's worth recapping really quickly what I think John put in his note to the company a couple of weeks ago before I joined, but I won't dwell on the details. So I spent 10 or so years in finance and in banking, the past couple of years working for a software startup, and the past 6 or so years across both those industries in the UK. And ultimately, my wife, Alex and Eddie Taylor's eldest daughter, John and Eddie Taylor's eldest daughter, Alex, decided that the most important thing for us was to get closer to family. My family's Massachusetts-based. Of course, the Taylors are Florida-based. And we made that call about 18 months ago that we wanted to get back over here. At that point, we had one young child. We have two more on the way in early November, which we can perhaps talk about later. And we made that decision, and then we began looking at the options. How could we get back here from a career perspective? What were the options for me? And at about the same time, coincidentally, more than anything, John, Alex, Eddie, and I had a conversation about potentially joining the family business. And to be honest, at that point, I knew sparingly little about the beer industry, about wholesalers, and about J.J. Taylor in particular.
Just what you picked up at the Thanksgiving table, right?
Exactly, what I picked up at the Thanksgiving table. So we spent a bit of time talking to John and better understanding the industry, better understanding J.J. Taylor. John was kind enough to give me access to people in his network, some of his advisors, other people in the industry, people within J.J. Taylor. And I did my due diligence and, really sort of worked it through to understand what this opportunity would be like and understand John's vision for the company long term and what was happening within the industry sort of more broadly. And, the consensus after talking to all of those people was, there's no better industry to be in. And if you're going to be in the industry, there's no better company to work for. And that then made it a relatively easy decision. So we then decided that this was the right opportunity for us as a family. It solved our problem. It got us closer to the Taylors and closer to my family. And it was a wonderful opportunity to join a family business that is, as far as I could tell before joining, and as far as I can tell now after speaking to people the past 2.5 weeks, is an incredible place.
Well, I think we'd all agree with you on as far as being happy to be here, because I know it's generally always the consensus around. We've got so many people who have been here for so long, and it's because it is exactly what you said. It's a great family business. It's a group of people that love working together in an industry that's just fun to be in. I've been fortunate throughout my career to always have jobs that when you tell people what you do, they're always a little excited to hear about it. And I think this is just another one of those that when you tell people you work in the beer industry, they're never unhappy to hear what you do. And that makes it fun. It's fun to work for a place that people get excited to hear about. It's fun to work for a place that people think is cool and interesting and necessary. And, in this year, and especially being essential, has been great, obviously, for us. And at the same time, within this industry, there's really, only a handful of companies that have a reputation on par with ours. So I can see why all that would come together, and glad it worked out in a good way.
Well, either of the past companies I worked at, I think if I cracked an alcoholic beverage at 9:30 a.m., I would have been escorted out the door. So this is a nice perk.
It is a nice perk. Yeah. It's one of those weird things that people ask about when I talk about for the job. In fact, I had a doctor's appointment a couple of weeks back. The doctor was going through the checklist. I'm like, do you drink? And I'm like, only for work. Which she's like, really? I'm like, yeah, it's a weird gig, but it's great, you know? So it's a fun industry, no doubt. So I'm going to open up here and start taking questions pretty soon. So before we do, I want to get just a bit more about your background. Obviously, like you said, came over from having worked in some different stuff. And I think it'd be fun for people to know a bit more about how you got started and where your background lies coming in, especially being into the financial side of things and how that makes sense and aligns for you.
So really quick sort of family background for me. Born and raised in southern Massachusetts in between Rhode Island and Cape Cod. I come from a very large family, only one of four children in my immediate family, but my mother was one of nine, my father was one of eight, almost all their siblings were married, almost all of them had four or five children. So I have 70 or so first cousins.
Wow.
Almost all of whom still live in that southern Massachusetts area.
Oh my goodness.
So I had a lot of fun as a kid growing up with loads of cousins. After high school, went to college in Washington, D.C. After college, moved to Boston, got into financial services and banking, spent some time in Boston, moved to San Francisco for a while, back to Boston for a while, which is where Alex Taylor and I reconnected. And I think that the history of our relationship is quite interesting as well. So we can talk about that for a minute. And then we took an opportunity with my employer at the time to move overseas, a couple more years in banking and financial services over there, and then onto a software startup. The history of my relationship with the Taylor family goes back to when I think we were 8 or 10 years old.
Oh, wow.
And the town that I grew up in, Southern Mass, John's parents and then John and Eddie kept a house there and spent a couple of months during the summertime.
Okay.
So Alex and I knew each other from summer camp back when we were 10 or so years old. And we became close friends at that point, and that friendship and relationship continued through high school and into college. We went to the same university, went separate ways after college, and then reconnected when we both ended up back in Boston, I think in 2010, and the rest is history. We were married 2016. We had our first son, Wills, who's now 2 years old in 2018.
And adorable, because we get to see pictures around here.
Adorable. And hopefully when the world goes back to normal, it will be more than pictures and we can get him running around the hallways. And we have two more on the way, identical twin boys, due November 3rd.
I was going to say pretty soon. I mean, my goodness, if you weren't already, you know, running around after one, now you're about to be outnumbered.
Exactly.
Switch it over to zone defense.
Zone defense.
That's fantastic. No, that's fun. I didn't realize that you guys had known each other that long. So
long history.
All right. Well, we talked a little bit about work history, but specifically before you came here, the role you had, I think, was pretty interesting. So you're working with a company that does blockchain work. And most people, when they think blockchain, probably think, you know, bitcoins or something. But in fact, there's actually a lot more to what a blockchain is capable of. But an interesting startup out of London that was doing blockchain work. And tell us a little bit about the company, but also about your role there, because you had a pretty unique role within that organization.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about blockchain versus Bitcoin first, and then we'll talk about our company and my role. And I think you're right. I think the average reader assumes that one is the other. Bitcoin is blockchain and vice versa. And to some extent, there's truth in that, right? The first blockchain was the Bitcoin protocol. But as you said, there's myriad other use cases for blockchain. And at the end of the day, blockchain is overhyped and it's overcomplicated and it's really just a piece of software.
Right.
And if you put Bitcoin and Ethereum and Ripple XRP and all those other cryptocurrencies off to the side for a second, what blockchain is a piece of software that allows us to do things that we haven't been able to do historically. And it allows us to do it because it takes existing technologies, existing softwares, and it brings them together in a novel way using new sorts of data privacy and security and cryptography to allow parties, you and I, Jeff, who may not trust one another, to share data in a trusting way.
Right.
And it's really kind of that basic. The company that I worked at before is called R3. And early days, 2014, we sort of looked at this cryptocurrency revolution that was going on. And the view that we took is, This is a fad, right? None of these things really solve a problem which needs to be solved. but there's interesting technology that underpins these cryptocurrencies.
Right.
And we think that serves a bigger purpose.
Right. Because my understanding, my understanding is this deep, but my understanding is that the underlying, what you're dealing with is something that can create a lot of unique identifiers. And that there's a tremendous value in being able to unique identify every little bit of a process. You know, for example, in the training world, I've seen some people talk about credentialing. And, you know, there are a couple companies out there like Credly and stuff that do like the little, you know, tag for your LinkedIn profile or things like that. But the idea would be you could use blockchain to be able to say, here's how we know that you took a particular course, because at the end it generated this unique key that it can never be duplicated. It's the only one of its kind inside this chain, and it's always referenceable and it's always there. And so for things like invoicing and inventory and credentialing, there's a lot of applications beyond just the idea that, you know, you create this Bitcoin, which again is a unique identifier that can't be duplicated, which is why it supposedly has value. But it's also this idea that you can create a lot of unique number sets and a lot of unique pieces and then tie them to things that make them valuable, but also uniquely identified. And in the world of digital, where there's so much copying, the ability to have something that is essentially signed as the one and only by using a blockchain can be really useful. So I imagine you guys got to see some pretty interesting stuff in that realm.
We did, and you're absolutely right. And I think it, you know, perhaps the easiest way to think about it is this. Over the past 10, 20, 30 years, individual firms, individual companies, individual institutions across almost every industry have gone through some form of transformation, right? Digital transformation, operating model transformation. And the goal of those transformations was to make those individual companies more efficient, right? A lot of that came to how do we find redundancy amongst the data and documents that we're storing within the company, mm-hmm. and how do we create a single source for that data, right? So everything's pulling from this golden source. And all of that was done at a company level. What blockchain promises is you can take that same efficiency and you can do it at an industry level.
See, and that's got some interesting implications just here within the beer industry, because I know one of the things we've been struggling with on the IT side of the world lately is, and it's a marketing problem and a sales problem as well, but, you know, we've got all these suppliers and they feed 400 distributors nationwide like ourselves, and we're constantly trying to get data from them that is really, it's industry standard data, right? The stuff that's in a package description, its marketing photo, you know, the product dimensions, the size specs, the alcohol by volume. These are all things that are unique to a particular package of beer, and yet 400 suppliers need it. A few tens of thousands, if not, you know, hundreds of thousands of retailers need it. And wouldn't it be great if the supply side could get away together and say, hey, everything that Miller puts out and signs, this is it. And if you want to know what the official description or product specs are on this package, almost like a UPC, but even more so, because again, a UPC could be mistyped, misduplicated, because the numbers could get, you got to register those. It's a whole thing. This becomes a way to almost even go a step deeper and say, now this is it. This is the official product description from Miller. You know what you're getting, and it comes through. So there's probably some applications even in our world that'll make sense over time.
There are, certainly ABI has had a couple of use cases out there. I'm not sure any of them have been successful at this point, but their focus was really on the supply chain side. And take that sort of same example, right? So three-tier system, how do you create efficiencies so that the suppliers, the wholesalers, and the retailers aren't each maintaining their own accounting and inventory records, which need to be reconciled against invoices, and create an application that allows everyone to contribute and collaborate to maintain a single record of that information and that data. And the hardest part about blockchain technology is not the technology. It's that collaboration across competitors, right, and other interested parties. You know, the way we did it at the firm I was at previously is we built a consortium and we brought 100 banks together. Most of them were investors, and we gave them incentives to collaborate and work together to solve industry-wide problems as opposed to problems just within single companies.
And that is the hard part, right? Business is That's business is easy until people get involved.
Of course.
That actually takes me a little bit, and I see some questions are popping up. We are going to get to them here in just a second. But that takes me to the next question I had, because your role at this company was kind of unique. I think the official title was chief of staff. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But you were doing really, what you were really focused on a lot was the recruiting and the people side of things. So talk to us a little bit about what you were doing there, because I think that's something people may be interested to know is, for someone whose background is so much in finance and numbers and the math side of the world, you actually had a very large role in the people part of that organization.
I did. When I started, we were 40 or so people. And when I left in June, we were 350 or so. And we had, a unique opportunity when you're growing a firm that quickly to set a company culture sort of from the start and sit down and take the opportunity to define what we want that culture to be. And then through every aspect of the company, including recruiting and hiring and training and all that, ensure that we're instilling that culture deep within the firm. And I was passionate about it when I first joined. And as we began to grow, I took the view that we weren't doing enough. We weren't doing it correctly. And to be honest, I grabbed those functions and sort of pulled them underneath me. We were hiring extremely quickly in a sort of space that has extremely high turnover, right? Technology companies, if you keep good engineers for 2 years.
Oh, yeah. It's the market could not be more competitive. I mean, I think there's actually a few companies now that are having to list their certain engineers on their SEC filings because of how valuable they've become.
Exactly. And we were losing some of our talented engineers to the bigger companies, to the Facebooks and Googles of the world, who, to be honest, could pay what we couldn't pay.
Absolutely.
But I took a keen interest in that, and we built really interesting recruitment and hiring and training practices, which served us pretty well. Our employees, by and large, through surveys that we did and sort of day-to-day interactions, loved the organization. And it was something that I was pretty proud of by the time that I left to have built that sort of culture and found ways to integrate that culture within aspects of the firm. And in addition to sort of the recruiting side of things, I was responsible for sort of overall company strategy and planning, responsible for company communications, investor relations and managing our board of directors, fundraising. But it was important to have that people side because the rest of that didn't really matter if we didn't get that first part right.
Exactly. Now that's great. That's great stuff. And all stuff that will serve well to transition into a role like this. Cause again, at the end of the day, it's, we sell beer, but we're in the people business, absolutely, as we like to say. So we got a few questions coming in and I'm going to grab one here off the chat. And I think it's apropos for the discussion we've been having. Question from Suzanne Borges, our HR director in Tampa. What excited you most about this new position or about joining the company?
Great question. What excited me most? Probably that it was new. I love learning. I believe in lifelong learning. And to come into something that, again, I knew sparingly little about and have a blank slate and be given the opportunity to spend these first 4 or so months out there in the field with people, building relationships with individuals, but also understanding their roles and understanding how the organization works and beyond that, how the three-tier system works and what's going on in the industry. To be given the opportunity to learn something new was probably the most exciting part for me. And then certainly once I got here and spent just the first couple of days talking to people and seeing the passion and the dedication and the love, to be honest, that people have for this organization, it's incredible.
Yeah, we have a lot of people who have, like I said, they've been here a long time. They really love it. And it seeps through. I remember 10 years ago coming on board and it was exactly the same vibe, which is great because it's so baked into the DNA we've got here. So during your road tour, this is another question from the chat. During your road tour in Florida so far, what do you think is the most useful thing you've learned?
The most useful thing I've learned? That's a great question as well. I think the most useful thing that I've learned is that I need to spend a lot more time on the road in Florida. I had the opportunity to spend a day and a half in Tampa, a half a day in Fort Myers, a couple hours yesterday, the Treasure Coast. And, I need countless more trips and countless more hours. building those relationships and understanding how things work. So it, I think when we were trying to figure out the right sort of schedule over the first couple of months for me to come up to speed, working closely with you, Jeff, we were debating whether getting out into the field early was the right thing or whether we should focus on sort of understanding the corporate side and then get out there. I think being out there week two was really valuable for me, because if you don't have the opportunity to see that and see it in person,
oh, absolutely,
the rest of it doesn't make sense.
It is a business that makes the most sense when you get out and get your hands on it. And obviously the challenge of that is, you know, it's COVID summer here. And that's been part of the difficulty in figuring out that right balance, because we want to, you know, of course, make sure that we're not exposing our teams to too many new people and from outside places. Babies on the way and probably going to have to go into quarantining soon to make sure you can be in the delivery room, and all that is a challenge for you and your family as well. So it definitely is changed the nature of things, but it's nice to see that even in a time like this, we haven't had to drop our core principles or our core tenets of, we know people learn best by getting out there. And the more time you get to spend, the more fun it becomes, because you just start uncovering more and more things. So let's talk a little bit more about the onboarding experience that you're having so far, because we did, you know, mention that you've been out a little bit. You've been here a little bit. Obviously, I think, you know, people are sort of curious, what does your timeline and roadmap look like through the end of the year? We got a big transition coming up with Hank transitioning into his advisory role. You want to give people a little preview and kind of let them know what to expect, because I know you've got more to do in getting out there, but also, you know, a lot to do here as well between family and the business side is all that's going on.
Yep, happy to. I think if I look at my priorities for the first, call it 4 months through the end of this year, but really the priorities probably don't change that much for sort of year two and year three for me. Priority one is people. This is a family business. Many people at the company have been here for years or decades. And I want to build those personal relationships with as many individuals within the company as possible. So that's priority number one, is spending time here, spending time in Minneapolis, spending time in Tampa, Fort Myers, Treasure Coast, with people, building those personal relationships. And some of that is about, you know, what's your role, and more so it's about what's your family life and what are your hobbies and those sorts of things. So that's probably priority number one for me. Second, I would say, is a broad understanding of the organization, the industry, the three-tier system, how all this comes together. And then within that, it's my role specifically in understanding Hank's responsibilities and areas of focus to date, and those things that I'll need to pick up come January. At the end of the day, there's obviously an incredible team here. Hank has an incredible team. I think that if I weren't to show up in January, things would probably continue perfectly fine without me, which is comforting coming into a new role.
Absolutely.
So my goal is to learn and figure out where I can add value longer term.
No, absolutely. And you know, no one ever really retires from this place. That's one of the little secrets we have. Pachi was here just not a week ago in his office, and I got to hang out and spend some time talking to him and stuff, because he's still in touch with our people and still comes by to see us. And that's one of the great things, again, about being a family business, about people who genuinely love what they do, love the company that they're working for, is as much as we're, you know, really excited that Hank's going to be able to transition into a role that gives him more time with his grandkids and the things he wants to do, we know he's always going to be around and helping us out and making that transition nice and smooth for us. So one of the things we've gotten good at in the last few years, I would say, is these types of transitions. You know, we've had a couple of key VPs in the last few years that have done this, and they've done it very well. And I think, you know, this proactive approach, and this is something that, to their credit, the steering committee has gotten really smart about and really understanding of and embraced, is these big transitions need the right amount of time and the right amount of handoff. And it's a relay race, and you can't just, you know, stop here and start there. There's got to be that pacing, and there's got to be that handing of the baton, as we say, to make sure that everything keeps running forward. So let's talk about some of the fun stuff and getting to know some of the funner things, because I do have a few questions here in the chat that I think are right up that alley. And as much as I know you want to get to know all the people around here, and I'm sure you will, they want to get to know you too. So I'm going to ask a few of the questions that they've got coming in through the chat, okay, starting with the probably the biggest, most important question that I'm going to get to ask you today, which is, what's your favorite beer?
Oh.
I apologize. If you'd rather jump to religion and politics so we do something less controversial, I could, but they want to know, and I can't deny the people what they want. So, favorite beer. Yeah, it's the only thing we really care about.
No, fair enough. I will say my beer preferences change pretty regularly. But over the past 6 or so months, my go-to beer has been Miller 64.
Miller 64.
It's hot here in the summer.
And it is. Is quite refreshing. I like that pick. That is an unconventional pick, but I like it. You got the light stable hops working. You got a low-cal, high taste option. I'm down for that.
Now, recently, I was given a case of Hilo, and I've got to say
that's the new one for anybody that does. That's the new one from Cigar City. This is their low-cal version of their famous High Lie. So if you haven't seen it yet, it's hitting the market and hitting the shelves rapidly.
Low-cal and lower alk, I think at 4% even.
Yeah.
So that will always be in my refrigerator going forward. I
think. Don't you love when you find a new favorite?
It's great.
It's super fun to find a new favorite. All right. Any others that make honorable mention on your beer lineup list?
I would be remiss if I didn't mention Miller Lite.
Okay.
I'm a big Miller Lite drinker.
That runs in the family from what I can tell. So.
Yes.
And pays the bills. So we're always happy to include Miller Lite in the list. All right, good. So we got the big one out of the way. Let's see what else I've got here. Oh, this one's going to be fun. So one of our Tampa folks wants to know, what's it like being John Taylor's son-in-law? And what's, I should clarify, and specifically, what's it like having him as both a father-in-law and a boss?
Can we tell if John is listening in?
You know,
I'll have to cater my answer. Honestly, not blowing smoke. It's awesome. You know, for those who know John and know Eddie, I mean, you couldn't ask for a better mother-in-law and father-in-law, right? They're wonderful people. They are extremely fun people. When we moved here in March, we ended up shacking up with John and Eddie for 3 or so months. And, you know, the idea, I think, to many people of living with your in-laws for 3 or so months is probably frightening. And maybe it was when we first came over. I can't remember. But it was excellent. They're just wonderful people. They've always been extremely supportive of me and, of course, of Alex. And, you know, I couldn't ask for a better mother-in-law and father-in-law. What is working for your mother and father-in-law, your mother-in-law and father-in-law like? I don't really know yet. John is, you know, he's giving me leeway, to get out and explore and try and get myself up to speed. And, you know, we talk regularly, but so far so good. If at some point, you know, we have a bad quarter and I'm sitting across from my mother-in-law and father-in-law in a boardroom, it may be difficult. But no, by as far as I can tell, working for them will be as wonderful as just being a son-in-law.
There you go. All right. Good answer. Good answer. No edits required. That one worked on its own. Good. I'm curious, what was your favorite and least favorite parts of living in London? Because as someone who has not lived abroad, and I know that's probably true of a lot of our teams and stuff, I can't help but wonder, what kind of perspective does that add, and what does that bring to how you deal with the people, how you think about the business and things like that? Because it's certainly a different perspective on the world.
It is. There are many things that we loved about living in London. I think, first of all, it's a really easy place to live. You know, as an American moving abroad, I think moving to a place like Paris or Madrid would be difficult. Language barriers, but also the culture is just a bit more different. Moving to the UK was easy. I think if I were to list our favorite things about it, one is it's culture, right? It's arguably, and in my view, the best city in the world, but arguably one of the greatest cities in the world. You have almost an unlimited amount of culture by way of theater, music, truly just other cultures coming together. You know, your neighbors are from any number of different countries. You work with a very diverse population of people. So that cultural side, I think, was really important to us. The ability to travel. know, you can leave 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon on a train from London, and you can be in Paris by 7:30 for a glass of wine or a beer. So that proximity to Europe and the ability to travel was wonderful. And to be honest, the place we probably spent the most time outside of our own apartment and my office was the pub. And if you haven't been to London, you have to go, if only for the pub culture. It's fantastic. It's a place where people just get together to socialize. It's not quite like the bar culture here.
Right.
There's a little something about it. You know, you become very friendly with the...
it's like the town hall, but with drinks.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it was a public house. It was a place where people who didn't have space in their own homes to socialize used to get together at the public house because it was a communal space. And it still works that way. And, you know, maybe we spent a little too much time there. But even after our son Wills was born, we were probably at the pub Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, almost every week. To the point where Wills became very friendly with some of the bartenders. And when we would walk in, they would take him and bring him behind the bar, and he would help serve drinks.
It's a good way to pick up a few extra tips, too, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's shift back over to the business side for a couple of minutes. And tell me a little bit about the way you like to lead teams and sort of your philosophy behind how you see yourself as a leader and what you consider your leadership style.
Yeah, good question. I consider it to be a phased approach. And what I mean by that is, especially coming into a new role or taking on new responsibilities in an existing role, sort of phase one is understand what those new responsibilities are and work closely with the members of that team to understand what they're responsible for, what their goals and objectives are, and how they like to operate as individuals and managers themselves. So getting that understanding and context is really important. Phase two is about long-term goal and objective setting. And my style is to work with the people that work for me to set those bigger picture goals and objectives and have the intellectual debate about how they're going to get there, and then to let them get on with it and do their jobs and be there really as someone to break down roadblocks, someone to help them solve problems, someone to help them get things done when they can't get it done. But otherwise, to let really smart people do their jobs really, really well, which seems, as far as I can tell, to be pretty much the J.J. Taylor culture.
Yeah. Hire talented and smart people, give them the authority to get the job done, get out of their way until they need help. I think that sums up a lot of how we do things around here, which is great because that definitely fits the culture and the way it goes. So what are some things you're looking forward to getting into inside the business and inside the industry? Some stuff you've either heard tell about and are looking forward to seeing up close for yourself, or just parts of the business you haven't had a chance to get up close and personal with that you're excited to?
Yeah, good question as well. I guess going back to the discussion a few minutes ago, you know, I really want to get a better sense for the operations. I really want to spend a night in Tampa and, you know, maybe help out on the pick lines. I'm not sure I'm cut out for it, but maybe do that. I want to get out with the drivers. I want to get out with the sales guys and the merchandisers. I want to learn sort of hands-on how this business operates. So that, I guess, is probably something that realistically I won't be able to do until Q1 next year, but maybe a little bit of it between now and then.
Excellent. And any functions of the business that you find particularly intriguing or interesting, just from a personal, it doesn't have to be strictly because it's within your scope or an area, but just things that you've maybe heard about and are like, I want to see how that works because I'm just curious.
Yes, let me answer the question in a slightly different way.
Sure.
So this is, I think it's a fascinating time to join this business and this industry, right? You know, we're still sort of riding the craft wave that started 30 years ago, but really proliferated 10 or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we have seltzer and beyond seltzer, F&Bs and ready to drink more broadly.
Flavor has changed everything in a lot of ways.
Exactly. You know, we have a lot going on, I think, with people looking for healthier choices. There's interesting opportunities with e-commerce, I think. And then we have a global pandemic on top of it, which has shifted from the on-premise to the off-premise. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are coming together, which will create challenges, of course, and have already, but also will create loads of opportunities. So I guess to answer the question in a very roundabout way, what I'm interested in is beginning to understand each of those challenges and opportunities and trying to figure out what JJ Taylor can do to further capitalize on some of those things.
I like that answer because I agree so much. It's a very liminal time in, I think, the world and our history. And that, of course, applies to us as well. You know, we talked a little bit about this on the last roundtable with Mike Bomani, but it's something I've been sort of getting back to repeatedly, both, you know, in the podcast and in other places, that the hardest part of change is the catalyst. The hardest part of change is getting people to agree to change, because people get comfortable and we get set in our ways. And if it's not broke, why fix it? And yet here, 2020 has been a year that has sort of forced change on everyone, right? We are in a situation now where change is just accepted. Things are going to be different. And we keep talking about, well, what will the next normal, not new normal, but the next normal look like? Because it won't be the same as it was before. And as someone who thrives on change, what I'm excited about is when you have an opportunity like this that, okay, people have now accepted the emotional part of it can't go back to the way it was, or it's not going to be the same as it used to be. There's an opportunity there. There's a moment there to build it back better and to do something different and to rebound stronger than we've been and come out the other side, not just different because we had to, but different because we could. And what are those opportunities look like? That's certainly something I'm always excited about. And, you know, we've tried to do exactly that in learning and in some other places, is how do we take advantage of this time in which everybody says, yeah, okay, things are going to be different. Different doesn't have to be worse. Different can be a lot better. And there is a moment there to sort of capitalize it. So it's definitely a fun time because I think the whole world is primed for something different.
Absolutely.
All right. So here we go. You ready for some quick hit questions?
Absolutely.
All right. Any weird hobbies we should know about?
Weird. I don't think I have weird hobbies per se.
We'll be the judge of that, Zach. You just tell us the hobbies. We'll decide if they're weird.
So, you know, an ideal weekend for Alex, Wills, and I. A couple of dinners at home. We like to do a lot of cooking ourselves. We like to do a lot of hiking and walking. So we're beginning to explore, now that it's cooled off a little bit here in Florida, we're beginning to explore some of the sort of nature trails and nature preserves. We like to do a little bit of cycling. Like to get on the water and get to the beach. I don't think any of that's particularly weird.
No, none of that particularly weird. So you mentioned cycling, and of course cycling's a big one around this office and throughout the company. Will you be out running a century with our COO anytime in the near future?
No, I bumped into Jay just walking from building to building, and he had just gotten back from a 50-mile ride, I think. Mm-hmm. I did a 30-minute spin this morning. I'm not sure it really compares. But years ago, actually, before we moved to London, we got into cycling primarily because there's a charity ride in Massachusetts called the Pan Mass Challenge, which is to raise money for Dana-Farber. And we did that 4 years, I think, which is a 190-mile ride split over 2 days. And really enjoyed it, enjoyed the sort of camaraderie of the ride, and obviously for a really good cause. But I think the days of 100-plus mile bike rides are behind.
All right. What was the last book you read?
The last book I read, so I reread some books which I had read a number of times previously, but reread because they are sort of the J.J. Taylor management philosophy books, Five Dysfunctions of a Team and First Break All the Rules. But I think after that, I read a book called Team of Teams. Sort of fits with those two books actually quite nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And Team of Teams was written by the U.S. general that ran special ops, special forces in Afghanistan. And it's a fascinating book. Essentially, the punchline of the book is, for years, corporate America, from call it the late 1800s through today for most companies, to be honest, corporate America, but also the military, had moved towards Taylorism, not John Taylorism, but Taylorism, in that the goal was to make every operation as efficient as possible. And you do that by breaking it down to its component parts, and you make each of those component parts as efficient as possible, and then you, you build those up, make it repeatable. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, manufacturing and things of that nature, that, that worked very well.
Right.
And it worked for decades, for generations. But the view of the author is it doesn't work anymore for any business or any industry, or in this case, armed forces, when you reach a level of complexity.
Right.
And rather than breaking down processes into these component parts and making them efficient, what you really need to do, as you said earlier, Jeff, is you have to hire really good people, and you have to give them the authority and the ability to make decisions and run their organizations quickly, and you have to give them the information they need to be able to do that. And the example that he uses is when he took over this post in Afghanistan, 2003, I think, the Special Forces Task Force was failing. We were losing the war.
Right.
And he believes the reason that we were losing is because we were fighting an enemy that was very adaptable, that was decentralized, that didn't have a top-down command structure, and we did. And so they broke that down, and they created a new organization for Special Forces, and they were far more effective. They were able to run far more missions. They were able to adapt and make decisions, you know, in the heat of the moment, because that decision making was pushed down to the people in the field that had the information they needed to do it, rather than pushing everything back up and forcing it down through a corporate hierarchy. I know it was a very long answer, but it was a great book.
It's a great book because he does a great job laying out, you know, how it was almost the burden of technology. All of a sudden, when the generals realized they could get information and intel at the speed of, you know, the internet, they started wanting it all. And what actually ended up happening was they created much more bottlenecking than they realized, because they didn't get the fact that just because we can get the information all the way up the chain and back down in, you know, the digital age, didn't mean that that was necessarily the best use of those people's time, or that they would be able to be deep enough on the issues at hand. So any hidden talents we should know about?
Oh, hidden talents.
You juggle or play guitar or anything we should make you do at a company meeting someday?
I don't. I wish that I did. I wish I did. I have no hidden talents. Not that I'm aware of, anyhow.
All talents on display at all times.
Exactly.
All right, fair enough.
What you see is what you get.
Bucket list vacation.
Bucket list vacation. You know, we're big outdoors people, and as I said before, we love hiking. We've done some sort of hut-to-hut hiking trips through mountains in Europe. Those are probably my favorite sorts of vacations. It's no frills, right? You're kind of in a bunk room in a hut at 8,000 feet. I would love to do more of that, and I'd love to do some of that in South America. I think we need the children to be a little older before we do it, though.
Probably. You should at least get them walking.
Exactly.
Favorite part of being a dad?
That should be an easy question, but there's obviously, of course, a lot of things to love about it. You know, this is maybe a corny response, but it's unconditional love. Now, he can be a pain in the ass sometimes, too. Don't get me wrong. But you know, this morning... I was able to get him from his crib at 7:45, whatever it was. And that sort of priceless look on his face when you walk in and turn on the lights and he looks at you and says, Dada.
That'll do it.
That's the favorite part.
That'll keep you coming back every time. So how's the Florida transition? I'll sort of ask this one as well. You know, obviously, I'm sure you've been to Florida many times with the family being here and so forth. But living here, very different. And you moved down at, you know, the best possible time in terms of transition in the world, but probably the worst possible time of the year in terms of actual weather, because it has been one of the hottest summers we have had in quite some time. Coming off of London, which is notoriously cold and wet, and the Northeast, which is also cold, if not as wet as often. How's that transition been going? How are you adapting to the weather here?
So far, so good. It has been hot. I'm actually one of those people that I love the weather in London. So, you know, if you don't know, the weather in London has a bad reputation. It's not actually that bad. You know, the average summer temperature is probably 70, 75 degrees. The average winter temperature is maybe 40, 45. So you never get those extremes.
Right.
Which makes it, it's always great pub weather. It's always great walking weather. So coming from that to the heat of Florida, or going from that, to be honest, to the extreme cold of New England would have been a difficult change. But I think we're adapting. I was happy yesterday when I walked outside and it was 75 degrees.
There was an actual breeze. The humidity dialed down just enough to finally go, this is okay.
The change was great. You know, I actually, before moving here, I had spent almost no time here.
Oh, really?
You know, we would come down once in a while for a holiday with the Taylor family. But I'd say cumulatively over the past 10 years, you know, if I spent more than 15 days here, that would surprise me.
Wow.
So I didn't know much about it, but heard great things and figured we'll dive in head first and I'll try and become Florida man. And you know, I got sunburn and then I got a bit of a tan for the first time in 6 years.
Hey, there you go.
And now that we're turning the corner from the heat of summer, hopefully to cooler temps for the fall and winter.
To lesser summer. Yes, that's what we do.
I'll be much more comfortable.
We have two temperatures in Florida. We have heat and less heat. Those are the two that we do year round. As a native Floridian, I will tell you.
It's tolerable. It's not great, but it's tolerable.
It takes a few years to get used to. Once you get used to it a little bit, that it's better. Although my wife is from Wisconsin and she still is not used to it. So maybe it'll never quite happen. My mom's been here for 40 years now, and she's still some days like, oh, just give me fall leaves and something pumpkin spice. I can't handle this.
I'm kind of with her.
That's what we have Minnesota for, because they are having their full-on fall bloom right now. So that's the beauty of it, is get up there and see it all change and enjoy that. Yeah, so Minnesota, let's talk Minnesota for a second, because we haven't yet. But obviously on your to-do list as well is get up and see our Minnesota teams as soon as travel will allow. It's our oldest division, and it's, you know, definitely a division that has a lot different market to contend with. What are your thoughts so far on Minnesota as far as what you've learned, and what are you looking forward to about getting up and seeing them?
So, I am very happy that we actually have a date on the calendar. I think we're headed to Minnesota on October 6th.
Excellent.
I've had the opportunity, I think week one, to speak with Chris Morton and his team. And beyond that, I haven't really had the opportunity to engage much with the team or the operation, in Minnesota. But hopefully that will start in earnest that first or second week in October. And then, you know, I like getting to Tampa and Fort Myers and Fort Pierce. You know, my hope is to spend a significant amount of time there over the next, call it 6 to 12 months, to build those relationships and understand the operation and how the culture works and what differences there might be to the Florida culture, and begin to build that sort of base of knowledge. But to date, it's been very limited.
Yeah, it's a fun place, great city. I always like to say it's remarkably the same, because we do the same stuff, and yet remarkably different, because it is a very different culture and a very different team. But I love them so much, and I can't wait to get back and up and see them myself, because we haven't been able to get up there much this year for reasons, as we all know.
Obvious reasons, yeah.
We're getting ready to wrap up, and I'll see if anything else pops through here. But as we do, final thoughts, things you want to tell us, message you've got for people as you're getting around, and things you'd want anybody to know as you're coming on board.
No, I think we covered quite a bit. I guess final thoughts. One, I'm really happy to be here. The first 2.5 weeks have been excellent. The people that I've been able to spend time with are awesome. You know, any sort of concerns that I had coming in, I think have all been alleviated. I guess my ask is this, knowing that my number one priority is the people, and then also to understand the business. I'm going to try to reach out to as many folks as possible, and engage one-on-one, but also my ask would be, come the other way. Reach out to me, call me, email me. I'm all over Teams. If we haven't met, introduce yourself. I want to learn about you and build that personal relationship. And then I guess the corollary there will be, please have patience with potentially stupid questions, because I will likely be asking many of them over the coming months and years.
Yeah, As a company trader, I like to say there are no stupid questions, just stupid people that ask obvious questions they shouldn't. No, I'm kidding. I kid because I love. But yes, good. No, and that's what it's all about, guys. It's, you know, as always, when it comes to being first choice, it starts first and foremost with our people. And we want you guys to feel free to come and talk to Zach, ask him anything. If you see him in the hallway, say hi. And I'm sure he'll happily show you pictures of the kids and answer any questions you want to know. And as always with all of us, you know, our doors are open. So feel free to get a hold of him. Zach, we really appreciate you taking the time this morning to sit down with us and let people get to know you a little bit better here through the podcast and be at the virtual roundtable with us today. So thank you very much for making this available to everybody.
Thank you for hosting, and thanks to everyone who took the time to join and ask some questions.
Absolutely. And that is going to do it for us this week on the Brew University Virtual Roundtable. Our next virtual roundtable will be coming at the beginning of October. More information to come soon, but get ready as we get back to the roundtable soon. Thank you to everybody who joined us here this morning and everybody who asked questions. We appreciate you guys being involved, and we'll see you next time here at the roundtable.